From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in the final week before childbirth. If a mother is fortunate, it's around 39 weeks with just days to go. But research finds that if you ask many mothers-to-be about what their childbirth will cost, they don't know. According to various sources, the average cost of a vaginal birth is $13,000 in this country. A cesarean section averages around $23,000. Now, that doesn't mean the patient pays the full amount, but millions of people are on high-deductible plans and can easily pay five figures. It also can depend on when your pregnancy started. Does it stretch into a new calendar year? Does a deductible restart? All kinds of questions. There are unexpected costs. There are infections, extended hospital stays, or other complications. And tack on the fact that paid leave is inconsistent in this country, with many families getting very little support, and you have a situation in which pregnancy and childbirth becomes very expensive, often no matter your insurance. So with the likely overturning of Roe v. Wade, we examine what that might mean and how that could impact people differently. For example, Justice Amy Coney Barrett has said that if Roe v. Wade is overturned, we would see a lot more babies born and a much more robust adoption system. But that doesn't seem to take into account the costs and the unequal costs that might be imposed on people depending on their means. And coming up, we're going to talk to a longtime healthcare administrator for some perspective from within the system. And now let me talk to a couple of guests about their own experiences. Joining me in studio, let me welcome Cassandra Nichols, who is a mother of two children. Cassandra, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Mohini Sharma is on the line with us, organizing director at Metro Justice. Mohini, thank you for being with us as well.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Listeners, if you want to join the conversation here, we'll take some of your feedback later this hour. Email us connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. Cassandra, let me start with you. And Cassandra had reached out to me briefly on social media after I kind of brought up this question of unknown costs that end up hitting a lot of people. And I thought your story was not only compelling, but also sort of emblematic of what a lot of people go through. Take me through your story.
Thanks, Evan. So I grew up in Rochester, but moved away to Washington, D.C. for 10 years. So when I moved back to Rochester in 2014, my only experience with health insurance had been in the D.C. market. And so coming back to Rochester, I had high deductible health care plans as my options. I was a young, healthy adult and signed up for one with a $6,000 high deductible. I thought, there's no way I'll ever pay that. Well, that was, you know, November 2015, and then I got married in January of 2016, and then I was pregnant by March of 2016, which meant I was having a baby in December. So I was going to now be on the hook for that $6,000 deductible. So I thought, what can I do? I talked to my employer. I talked to the insurance company. I thought, there has to be a way I can change my health insurance plan. There has to be a way. This has to be a qualifying life event, which is typically the reason you can change your health insurance plan. But in 2016, getting pregnant was not. I've read recently that maybe that has changed, but in 2016, I could not change my health insurance plan. So my next option was to use the health savings account. Well, the health savings accounts that I believe the federal government, you know, puts into place for high deductible plans, they max out at $3,300. So why would you have a high deductible plan that forces me to pay $6,000 out of pocket if I can only save pre-tax in my health savings account $3,000, half of that? So now I knew even if I maxed out my health savings account, I still had to come up with $3,000. Finally, I thought, well, when I have the baby in December, I'm going to change my plan in that moment because having a baby is a qualifying life event. But I wasn't able to change my health insurance plan when the baby was born because it was too close to the end of the calendar year. It was a timing technicality. So now my $6,000 individual health savings, high deductible health plan was now a family high deductible health plan, and I was on the hook for $12,000. In the end, through my health savings account of $3,300 and something dollars, plus what I had to pay out of pocket, I paid around $7,765 to have my baby because I ended up having an emergency C-section and he needed special care nursery care at Highland Hospital for 5 days. So that was $7,000 I certainly didn't plan for, in addition to what happened next, in the sense of I had no paid family leave at the time. I had no pay for the 12 weeks I stayed at home. So if you take all the money I didn't earn plus all the money I spent, it's somewhere around $17,000 is what I lost out of my savings account when I had my first baby.
To qualify for any support, what ended up being, what, $130 a week? How did that happen for you?
Oh, so the New York State disability that I was able to qualify for, which is always also a fun little perk that when you have a baby and you try to apply for any money that you can qualify for, you have to mark pregnancy or the birth of your baby as a disability, which was just hard to say that this was a problem I was having. But nonetheless, that document that I had to fill out for New York State qualifies you for about $170 a week for, I believe it's 5 weeks for a vaginal birth or 7 weeks for a cesarean. And then they take taxes out of that. So I ended up receiving about $157 per paycheck. And I received 7 paychecks because I had a cesarean section. So that was roughly $1,000 that I got back from New York State as a disability payment.
Okay. Have you thought about the fact that, you know, your life situation might be a little bit more fortunate than a lot of people who are going through childbirth and thinking about the impact on them, trying to figure out bills, costs, et cetera?
100%. I mean, the only way that I was able to afford that is because I didn't have my first baby until I was 34. I had 12 years of a full-time job to be able to have a savings account, number one. But on top of that, I mean, I understand how systems work. I read insurance documents when I sign up for them with my employer, and I still miss this. It was appalling to me when it happened that I could miss this. If I'm missing this, how much more are other people missing?
When you think about a post-Roe America, I want to also make clear that we don't know. You can't immediately predict in a post-Roe America, which seems to be where we're heading, exactly what the impact on the number of total abortions would be. We certainly know that abortions still happen in places where they are illegal, in places where they are restricted. So I'm not making any predictions. I am simply observing some of the rhetoric that comes from the Supreme Court that, well, you know, if abortion's not an option, carry to term, a more robust adoption network, sort of everybody wins. Do you think that's missing some of the impact that is often not talked about here?
I would say in general, I think it's very convenient for everyone to oversimplify what it's like to be a mom, what it's like to be pregnant, what it's like to give birth. There's nothing simple about it. I think that the more appreciation and understanding that everyone has for that in this country, especially, the better off we all would be.
Mohini's story is, a little different, but I think important to understand as well. Mohini Sharma from Metro Justice is with us. Can you tell your story, Mohini?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm coming at this from the perspective of being someone who is trying to have a child and also has had 2 miscarriages. And, you know, I knew going into this that, like, miscarriages are very common. You know, almost a quarter of known pregnancies end in miscarriage. Doctors think at least half of unknown pregnancies end in miscarriage. So it's a very common thing, but it's also a very difficult and very painful thing. And I knew that, but what I didn't know was how expensive it is to have a miscarriage. And I found out when I had my first miscarriage in December, and it ended up costing me almost $1,000. My partner and I put that on a credit card. You know, we'll pay it off slowly. Luckily, we have some family that we can ask for help. But it just felt so cruel to have this really shocking, really emotionally and physically difficult experience, and then be forced to pay for it. You know, for that difficulty to come with a price tag, and an expensive one, just made a tough situation so much worse. Like, it really felt like being kicked when you were down. And the reason for that is that, you know, we have a privatized health insurance system that's run for profit, where health insurance companies basically determine what healthcare they cover and what they don't. And I, like a lot of people, am on a high deductible plan, you know, like Cassandra mentioned. And my plan will cover what it considers routine prenatal care without being subject to the deductible. But miscarriage is not considered routine prenatal care, despite how common of an experience it is, right? Like, it's not considered prenatal care, and therefore they won't cover it, and it's subject to the deductible. And I have a silver level plan. That premium costs my job $535 a month. And then on top of that, my deductible is $3,200. So we have to pay all that money for benefits to even start coming in. Then even then, I still have copays. So, well, the picture that we're looking at is that, I mean, one, the message that insurance companies are sending is that basically people's bodies don't matter. You know, especially female-bodied people, like, your bodies don't matter unless you're carrying a child. And the moment you're not carrying a child anymore, you're just out of luck and you don't matter and your health doesn't matter. And if you can't afford it, that's too bad. And it's just cruel. And when you think about the fact that many women have more than one, and then let's say you have a successful pregnancy. Now there's the actual birthing costs that Cassandra talked about. What you're looking at is a picture where the systems we have punish you for just trying to do everyday life things and put you in a place where you might have to make dangerous decisions and skimp on care for something that is a huge life event and has so many medical and emotional implications. And to think that you might have to skimp on costs, like, that's incredibly dangerous and just unnecessary when you think about the fact that, like, the system exists the way it does so that some shareholders and CEOs of health insurance can make as much money as possible.
Talking to Mohini Sharma and Cassandra Nichols about their experiences, and we're going to follow up with them in a moment, but I want to listen to some of the comments made this morning. I had a chance to talk to Jane Dodds, who is a recently retired medical practice administrator. In fact, I think, Cassandra, you said a little connection for you with Jane, is that right?
Yes. So I worked with Women's Gynecology and Childbirth Associates for the birth of both of my children, and I saw that Jane worked there.
Yeah. And so Jane's had a lot to say over the years on sort of the unequal healthcare and sometimes, in her view, inadequate healthcare in this country. And I thought we would talk about how she's seen it historically. So this is our conversation from this morning.
Thanks, Evan.
Let me start by asking you to kind of go back to the beginning of your career and your education and what you were seeing in regards to the debate about abortion.
Well, in the late 60s, early 70s, I was in college and then grad school. And around that time, there was a debate in New York about whether abortion should be legal, tied to whether or not contraceptives should be available to unmarried women, et cetera, et cetera. And it was actually the fiscal conservatives, which was mostly the Republican Party, that was pushing for legalization of contraception, family planning services, and the quiet part was abortion services, because everybody knew that it was much cheaper to provide contraception and family planning services than to bring a child into the world that would then be required for society to pay for. So, that was the beginning, and that's why clinics like Planned Parenthood and family planning clinics all over New York State were funded by the state, because we all knew it was cheaper to prevent unwanted pregnancies than to deal with the results.
How did you see that shift over the years, and what caused it?
To my mind, it was when the evangelicals took over the Republican Party and started trying to shame women into not using contraceptives. I worked at Planned Parenthood in the 80s, and at that time, we did not do termination services in Rochester, but we did counseling for such services. And there were more and more women who could have used birth control, but they weren't supposed to. They were shamed into not admitting that they were sexually active, so they couldn't use birth control without admitting that they were sexually active. And I think, you know, contrast us with Europe, where sex education is a normal part of everybody's education. family planning services are free and included with the national health care services. Their abortion rates are much lower than ours. Their teen pregnancy rates are practically non-existent. And kids wait longer in Europe to have sex because it's a normal part of life. And in this country, that's not true. Women are shamed, and it's all based, it's all, everybody points fingers at women. People don't always talk about the teen pregnancy rate. They don't talk about the fathers of those babies are mostly men in their 20s.
So now here we are looking at some of the leaked documents from Justice Alito's majority opinion that seems, from all the reporting, to be on track to what will be released officially next month. We've seen some of the comments made by Justice Amy Coney Barrett, and the description that, you know, especially in Justice Coney Barrett's view, that, you know, if we stopped abortion and women carried the babies to term, carried to term, and then we would see more adoption. We might see more families decide, more couples decide, more women decide, you know, I want to keep this baby. But otherwise, we could have a robust adoption network, and that it would work out for you know, for everybody. How do you see those claims, and maybe how do you see some of the issues that are not brought up in some of those opinions?
Well, I remember when abortion was not legal, and also my mom was a nurse trained at Strong in the late 40s. And she said the nurses in training all loved working the maternity ward, but the downside of that was you also had to work the septic ward, which is where women went when they were having results of illegal botched procedures, and that was common. I think Amy Coney Barrett and her ilk have no clue about how many women were maimed and died before abortion became legal. When abortion became legal, abortion became safe. In this country. And I think the legislation is turning us back into making women second-class citizens. You know, they talk about abortion not being mentioned in the Constitution. Well, taxing women wasn't mentioned in the Constitution either. So can I stop paying taxes?
Yeah, that's an interesting, it was an interesting point in the notion that something wasn't mentioned in the Constitution, so therefore it's not part of a long-held legal tradition. But let's also talk a little bit about, let's sort of create a little thought experiment here, Jane. If the reality that Justice Coney Barrett sees comes to pass and that we see a dramatic reduction in abortion, which again, historically we know is not likely to happen, it would shift sort of settings, as you say. But let's say in this thought experiment that she's right, that we see a dramatic reduction in abortions, there's a lot more caring to term. What is the impact, especially on women who are in more impoverished financial circumstances?
Oh, it's significantly greater than for women that have means and resources and a supportive family. You know, bearing a child, I mean, even going through a pregnancy, you have to take time off from work to go to the doctor. There are a lot of costs involved in being pregnant, delivering a baby, getting physically back in shape to go back to work or to care for that child. There's virtually non-existent child care for newborns, which is why people in countries with socialized medicine have almost universal year-long parental leave, because the cost of caring for a newborn for the first year is unsustainable for a daycare center. And we also know from studies that were done between the 70s and the 90s in countries where women were either allowed or not allowed to have abortions, that the women who wanted an abortion but weren't given the abortion bore children who were technically not wanted, and their family outcomes years later are much more difficult. There's higher crime rates, divorce rates, suicide rates. All of those things increase if women can't control their own fertility.
Even when there is insurance, even when a new mom has insurance, it can be, I think, a shock. And our guests are talking today about that. Can you talk a little bit about that as well? This notion that, well, you got insurance, so you know, it's going to be covered.
It's going to be covered with a deductible, with some co-pays, you don't know what else is going to happen. Pregnancy is a medical condition that can cause other medical conditions to happen. Again, you need to take time off from work. You got to see your obstetrician once a month for the first 6 months, twice a month in the seventh and eighth, and sometimes weekly in the ninth month, depending on how your baby's doing, and nobody can guarantee that. Time off from work for somebody who's working a minimum wage job with no sick time benefits means spending, you know, $20 or $30 of your time to go to a doctor's appointment that may be covered, but you also may have a copay. And then there are labs, and then there are ultrasounds, and then there are, you know, genetic screening and all of the things that have to happen to have a normal, healthy baby. Those things all add up. They nickel and dime you to death. And if you've got a high deductible plan, you're probably going to reach it. If you have a baby in the same year when you started your pregnancy, sometimes if your contract goes over the end of year and your company gets a new insurance policy and you have to stop one insurance and start another, you got to start your deductible all over again. You may end up doing that twice. And high deductible plans, which are the cheapest for employers to offer, are the most expensive for people who don't have that deductible. If you don't have $6,000 or $8,000 for a family deductible sitting in your bank account, that's all going on your credit record.
All right. So finally, if we hear those who support this potential ruling, those who oppose abortion, those who want to see Roe overturned, if we hear that sort of part of the political population and the population of the country say, okay, if this happens, if Roe's turned back and 20-some-odd states say no abortion at all and many other states have limitations, that we will then offer more robust child care support, we'll offer more robust family support, maternal support. Does that go somewhere with you? Do you take stock in that?
I don't believe it for a second. If we believed for a second that the Republicans were interested in helping our schools and our social network programs be better, they would have passed some of Joe Biden's legislation. Instead, what you're seeing is people trying to deny coverage. They're trying to deny coverage for contraception. What do they think is going to happen?
Yeah, the contraception part, I think, maybe we should end there. It does strike me as not consistent to say you want fewer abortions, but you also don't want robust support for contraception for all people. You agree with that?
Exactly. I would agree completely with that. Yeah.
Jane, thank you for making time. I know you're on the road. Thanks for being on the program today.
All righty. Thanks. Bye.
Jane Dodds is a recently retired medical practice administrator. And I'll ask both of our guests, Cassandra Nichols first, a mother of two children. Anything in that conversation sort of come back and ring true for you, or anything you want to add there?
I just want to point out the idea of like what's covered and not covered, because what I learned in 2016 was that before the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2014, we didn't even have coverage for the 15 or so belly checks. Every time you have to go in and get measured and make sure that you're growing on course, those were free for me in 2016. I didn't have to pay anything. But what was not included was the blood work to make sure that, you know, there weren't genetic defects. The ultrasounds are not covered. I paid $180 for the 20-week ultrasound to make sure that my baby had five toes on each foot and five fingers on each hand. How is that not a normal part of health care? That was the kind of stuff that stayed with me, that made me think no one is paying attention to the reality of growing a baby inside of you. And if we are not covering these things as like a normal thing you should get checked out when you're having a baby, then what are we saying as a society about this entire situation?
So when Jane Dodds is saying you kind of get nickeled and dimed to death, $180 here, $250 there, that's part of what I mean.
Yeah, so for example, I towards the end of one of my pregnancies, I was nervous. I don't remember if I was nervous about, you know, having a C-section again or trying to avoid one. So they were like, let's do a third ultrasound just to check. And I had the thought come to mind, I don't know if I want that other ultrasound because it's going to be another $180. And if I could avoid spending $200 and avoid knowing useful information about the birth of my baby, like when that thought crossed my mind that I was going to make a choice about my health because of how much it would cost, it made it very clear to me that like something is not right here.
Yeah. And when you think about high deductible health plans, which again, something in the 40%+ of Americans with private insurance are on high deductible plans. If you're on a high deductible plan that's $6,500, $7,000, $6,200, you often have to decide, you know, I've got this, I'm not even talking pregnancy, I'm talking about anything. I don't know if I want to go see a doctor for this. I have pain. I have unexplained headaches. I don't think I want to go. People are making those decisions all the time. And if, as Jane says, and as you say, Cassandra, pregnancy results in people saying, I don't think I can do $180 again. I'm just not going to go to this ultrasound. Or I don't know if I want to spend $200. I'm not going to go to this appointment. Then we're going to have worse outcomes, aren't we? Inevitably, aren't we?
I mean, theoretically. Theoretically, shouldn't we just take care of these people? I mean, it's enough stress for the mom to carry a baby and to have no idea what's happening inside of you all the time. And then to hesitate to go see your doctor.
Yeah, I guess maybe, I don't know, maybe a listener is hearing this going, hey, you're missing it. Here's the point of all this. And I guess I'll be open to that. You can call the program and tell me. But Mohini Sharma is someone who has been trying to have a baby and sharing your experience about what you've been dealing with. What stands out to you from that conversation?
A lot really resonates. I'll start with a couple things that Cassandra said that really resonated with me is that, like, having to make those choices, right, based on what you can or can't afford for your care, which is just an absolutely terrifying notion. And actually, the first thing my partner and I did when we, you know, made the decision to try and have children was to figure out what our health insurance options were. And I can't tell you how many hours on the phone between the New York State Marketplace and my health insurance company and how many tears of frustration were cried trying to figure that out. It was just an absolute nightmare. And at every turn, the message I got was that, like, this is just set up to be hard. It doesn't have to be like this, but it is. And at the time I was on an even higher deductible plan. So my deductible at the time was $6,000. And I was just looking at that and being like, how are we going to do this? Like, there has to be another option. So I definitely, you know, I share, a lot of those concerns, and some of those experiences with the conversation you had with Jane, was it?
Yep, Jane.
With Jane, I think one thing that stood out was, you know, the contradictions that were spoken about from the anti-abortion side of, like, hey, they say they value these babies' lives or they want less abortions, but then they aren't supportive of comprehensive sex education or contraception, and they don't support any of the public programs that actually make having a child, you know, financially, emotionally, et cetera, like, feasible. And I think the message to take away from those contradictions is that those contradictions exist because, well, what they're portraying is that this isn't about logic. Like, this isn't about lives. This isn't about logic. It certainly isn't about, like, what's actually healthy and beneficial for long term. It's clearly about power. Right. And that's why these contradictions exist, because they'll say whatever they need to say to advance whatever their agenda is. And right now, you know, this country for a long time has existed on the premise that, you know, rich, primarily male, primarily white people have power, and the exploitation and control and oppression of everyday people is what they need to continue profiting off of us, right? In every realm. So this really comes down to just another way that they're trying to exert control. And they'll make whatever argument they have to make to get there. And so when I sit here and I hear all of this, you know, I'm like, yes, they're hypocritical. Yes, there's contradictions. The fundamental problem is that they have power. And so our task becomes, okay, what can we do to flip that? Like, clearly, we need to have power. We need to change these systems. Now, how do we get there? Because the way this is going is untenable. If Roe v. Wade gets overturned, I think the very bleak picture was painted really well. And like, we can't let it get there. It's simply not something we can allow to happen. So a lot of what I've been, you know, spending, especially the last couple of weeks, thinking, it's like, okay, so what do we do?
On that note, let me get our only break of the hour, and we've got feedback from listeners in a number of different directions here. So we've got some phone lines open. We'll take your calls at 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI here in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. Mohini Sharma is on the line with us, an organizing director at Metro Justice, describing her own experiences in trying to have a baby and the costs associated there. Cassandra Nichols is a mother of two children, also sharing her story. And we're right back to your feedback after this only break. Coming up in our second hour, Rochester now has miles of bike boulevards. The bicycle infrastructure has been changing. And our producer, Megan Mack, got out on a bicycle this week with the team from Reconnect Rochester to go check it out, to go ride miles of these bike boulevards, to see what it's like for bicyclists. Have you tried it? Their full report coming up next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before I get to your many emails, you heard earlier from Jane Dodds, a recently retired medical practice administrator. This is one of the many other Janes. Regular caller. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Evan. Great show. Great program. I think that former guest of yours, I noticed that she changed the subject from the woman to the disorganized tissue that the woman is carrying, a fetus, which is when, well, it would become a fetus, which is when she would need to make a decision. And if she were really wanting to have a child just so she could have it adopted, she could do that. She's free to do that. She can choose that. So what's at stake here is when the woman does not have the right to choose to have an abortion or to be in charge of what happens to that delivered baby. And I agree so much with your guest that it's about power. It's about controlling women. And in my worst horror, it's about getting women back barefoot and pregnant. But it's always this abortion issue to me is always about the woman and not that disorganized little group of cells that she's carrying. And if she did so for 9 months, yes, it would be a baby if it were delivered alive. But until then, it is not. But thank you for this program so much.
All right, Jane, I appreciate that. The conversation about power there. Mohini, anything you want to add? Do we have Mohini? You might be on mute. Oh, there you are, Mohini.
Yeah.
Mohini, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm still here. No, I mean, I think that was all really well said and agree that, like, this is about so many lives, right? It's about the person's life who's carrying the child. It's about if that child comes into the world, what does that child's life look like, right? Especially if that pregnancy wasn't wanted. And if, frankly, the financial and social structures simply do not exist to support that parent and to support that child. You know, and I think that consideration is really important, and then all the other lives that might be a part of that family. So yeah, like, there are lives at stake, and when there are lives and health at stake, people deserve to be able to make a choice. So I really appreciated that call.
I want to read a few emails on the cost of labor and delivery and the decisions that people that are not theoretical, that people are making. So let me read a few emails on this. Millie, who is a mom of three, says there's a lot of discussion on the cost of pregnancy, which can be dangerously prohibitive, but many women go into labor not knowing how much their birth will cost their family. Personally, after I had my first child, the cost of a hospital birth was so high, I opted to birth at home for my second. I am fortunate that there were no complications and it was a positive experience, but the actual stress of laboring while thinking about the cost of each intervention needed is ridiculous. That's Millie, who chose to have a home birth because of the cost of birthing in a hospital. Writing from Canada, David says, speaking of just the birth costs, I'm reminded of my sister-in-law, who, living at the time in suburban Buffalo, chose to fly to her original home in Tunisia to give birth, to save the huge cost of giving birth in the United States. I'm so very sad and angry that America is going so backwards on this and abortion and more nowadays. Dave in Canada. But Mark writes to say, the lesson of this program, Evan, is that we all have to be more aware of our own insurance plans. That's from Mark. So Cassandra, Mark is saying, no, the lesson he's getting is you should have known more about your insurance and what it covers here.
Yeah, I mean, I think I knew everything about my insurance plan. I didn't know when I was going to get pregnant, right? Because you don't know how long that's going to take. But I think my question is, why are we okay with a $6,000 deductible? Why are we okay with a health savings account that's supposedly going to help you pay for that deductible that only covers $3,000? I think I've heard that the average family has the inability to pay for an unplanned $400 expense. So how are we supposed to pay for a $6,000 deductible that could come up from a pregnancy or from, you know, Mark hurting himself on the sidewalk on an icy day? You know, no one should be forced to pay that. Not forced, but I think we have to think long and hard about these choices we're faced with and how it affects real life, because I don't think that discussion is being had.
What would you say, Mohini, to Mark, who says the real lesson here is we all have to be better aware of our own insurance?
I mean, I think it's based on a fiction that the system is even understandable. I completely agree with Cassandra being like, still the crux of the question is like, are we really okay with how much this costs and the fact that it only costs this much to make a small amount of people a lot of money? I think that, you know, is point number one. And point number two is that it's just not a reasonable ask. This, if anyone has ever looked through these plans, right, and tried to shop for a plan and tried to figure it out, these booklets are enormous. They are difficult to read. There are a bunch of technicalities. Even doctors and billing departments barely understand them. The amount of doctors and hospital workers that I have spoken to that talk about what a headache the system is, even for them, to figure out what is covered, what is not covered, who do they bill, what is the code to bill. Like, it is kept intentionally difficult so that insurance companies can understand this and charge you as much as they want to charge. So I think the expectation of like, oh, you should just know your health plan better, it's completely unreasonable. And it's not how that has to be. And there are single payer systems, universal healthcare systems that are simpler, provide for everything, are affordable, and cover all of these bases. So yeah, my answer to that is like, that's a fictional solution.
Yeah, and I would just say to Mark, look, it's definitely a good thing to be as educated as you can be about your insurance, about what it covers, what it doesn't, about what you can learn about possible costs you're going to face. But there is an intentional opacity here that is very, very hard to get an answer. Imagine you need a hip replacement and you ask, how much is this going to cost? What's the cost of hip replacement? Do you get an answer in 5 minutes? It's really pretty amazing at times. Maddie writes to say, Cassandra mentioned that an ultrasound, 20-week ultrasound, was $180 for you.
Yep.
Maddie says, that would be with insurance. We are cash paying because we are self-employed. We were billed $1,500 for the 20-week ultrasound and the midwife to look at it for a few minutes. Insane. That's from Maddie.
Yeah. And again, she needs that ultrasound to know if that baby is growing okay. So...
But I think back to your earlier point, Cassandra, there will definitely be people who choose not to have that ultrasound or
right.
some other form of care because they're going, yeah, I'm not doing that. Out
yeah.
of pocket. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, again, like why are we okay with this as a society? Why are, and it's easy, I think, for people who are not having children. And I feel for the people who are having trouble having children. But, you know, men aren't giving birth and plenty of adults choose not to have children. And it's easy, I think, to say, well, it's not happening to me. So I'm sorry this is happening to you, but it's not my problem. But it always becomes your problem. These types of societal decisions come back around to everyone eventually.
Here's a different view. Listener says, when do insurance companies decide that you can add a newborn child to the policy? Because maybe that's when we should consider when a person is technically alive and beyond being allowed to have an abortion. Cassandra, what do you think?
It's interesting. That occurred to me recently. So my child was automatically added to my policy the minute that he was born. So it wasn't a choice per se. It just automatically happens. And like I said before, you are allowed to change your health insurance plan during that major life event of having a baby. But the timing of when the new plan goes into effect is different. And, you know, whether or not we use that as a way to determine the life of a baby is a different conversation. But it happens automatically. You don't get a choice.
Okay. But Mohini, taking this in maybe a different direction, if plans started saying, okay, you know, we'll cover anything related at 6 weeks, is that logically the marker to you that says, well, that's a human being and we're not going to allow abortion after 6 weeks?
I'm sorry, Evan, could you repeat the question?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a question of when, it's a question of when insurance companies decide that a child is added to the policy and listed as a person. And what Cassandra is pointing out is the moment her child was born, that child is now insured as a person. And I think what the emailer is saying is that's a good way of seeing how the system views when a person is a person, you know, this personhood debate. And therefore, you know, that is an interesting place to put the line for allowing abortion. I think Cassandra's point is those should be separate conversations. That's maybe it's an interest. I mean, the point, I guess, is taken here. But if insurance was saying, hey, it's 6 weeks, we'll cover everything related to, you know, the developing child, therefore, that's personhood, no abortion after 6 weeks. I'm not sure that's the right way to have that debate on where the lines are in abortion. What do you think, Mohini?
I completely agree. I think they are separate conversations. As long as, you know, there is a person carrying that child, it is in their body, they are, you know, on the hook for the financial, physical, emotional consequences of all of that. It is their choice. It has to be their choice. We already have a system that makes way too many healthcare decisions for people already. And they do that by deciding what is covered and what's not covered. And that should not be their prerogative. That is the prerogative of the person and the doctor. I think it's a separate conversation. I think once the child is born, that they're considered, you know, a person and have health and have healthcare ostensibly, you know, that's certainly a good thing. But yeah, I think bringing yet more for-profit entities whose primary interest is their bottom line and trying to define like when it is okay or not okay to have an abortion, that is incredibly dangerous.
Tom writes to say, where is personal responsibility in this conversation? If you have sex, you might get pregnant. If you get pregnant, you might have a child. And if you have a child, you should care for that child. You shouldn't expect anyone else to do that for you. You should take responsibility for your decisions. If you're lucky enough to have an insurance plan, you should know what it covers. Is anyone responsible anymore? That's Tom. Mohini, what do you think?
I think it is incredibly responsible to assess what you are and aren't able to do and are and aren't willing to do and then make the decision accordingly. And I think a completely fair choice in taking responsibility is to choose to terminate that pregnancy. I think the fact that like sex is attached to, you know, reproduction and having a child, and that's just, you know, sort of the purpose. And if you're not ready to accept that, don't have sex. I mean, that's a whole other realm, you know, of values that, you know, can be debated in a different place. But like, I think to say that, oh, it's not taking responsibility if you choose to have an abortion, I think that's just wrong. It's just wrong. And I think it's far more responsible to assess where you're at as a person, where your finances are, what you can or can't do, whether or not you want this child, whether or not you can give this child a good life, and go from there. That to me sounds way more responsible. And then there's also, you know, the fact that we don't have comprehensive sex education. We do not have comprehensive and free contraception. Like none of the things exist to even make conception a choice, a real choice before the fact. But I don't want to go down too far down that path because I think it obscures that like whether or not sex education and contraception is widely available, pregnancy and birth should still be a choice.
Okay, Cassandra Nichols, Thomas saying personal responsibility has been absent from this conversation. What do you think?
Well, I feel incredibly personally responsible for every decision I've made. And obviously, I paid for everything that I, you know, that was a consequence of my choice. That doesn't mean it was easy. That doesn't mean it didn't get in the way of me buying a home. It doesn't mean that those costs get in the way of me having more children than I have. So the fact still remains that the system in the United States is set up a certain way, and it makes it hard for someone like me who has a great job. And if it's hard for me, how is it for everyone else who doesn't have the same type of job that I have, or who doesn't have a husband who's doing everything he can to help? Again, it's just, if we are okay with this, I guess, you know, I'm glad that people can sleep well knowing that, but I'm not when there are other options over the border, not when in Toronto, they not only give you a year's leave as a new mother, but employers tell their employees that this mother has now picked up valuable skills. This mother is now a greater asset to our community, to our workforce. It's just happening hours from here. And in the United States, we continue to think that, you know, pregnancy and motherhood is like one gender's issue, one segment of that gender's problem. And they're the ones that have to be personally responsible for it. There's such a lack of community and understanding and empathy, I think.
Yeah, I think part of what Tom is arguing is that there's a lot of conversation this hour about the unequal impact of the cost of labor and delivery and the shock it can be, even to people who can find a way to afford it, let alone for people who feel paralyzed by medical costs. And Tom seems to be saying that if you are living in poverty, if you're struggling with finances, then don't have sex. That's part of the responsibility. I think that's part of what Tom is saying. I don't know that that is... I'm a fan of personal responsibility. I'm a fan of understanding human nature. I don't know if we're going to eliminate sex based on finances. I'm not sure that's where the society we want to rebuild. What do you think, Cassandra?
I mean, I'm no expert on the 50s and 60s, but I mean, I think they tried to limit sex, you know, back in a long time ago, and it didn't eliminate it. And our society, our culture, I mean, it doesn't do that.
The one other rejoinder to that is, when you think about abstinence-only education, which is prominent in the contiguous American South, it is almost perfectly aligned with the places that have the highest unwanted teen pregnancy. So it's not working. Anything to add there, Mohini?
I agree with you. I think we have the data to show that abstinence-only things don't work. I think the notion that, oh, poor people just shouldn't have sex is shaming. It's classist and it's out of touch with reality for a lot of the reasons that Cassandra and Evan, you both mentioned. And it also really just makes invisible the systemic causes of poverty as well, right? Like, so many people are working, but we don't have the availability of really good paying jobs with benefits, with security, you know, all of these things. And so there's just a lot going on with that statement that I think are wrong and have been proven to be wrong by data.
Last couple of minutes, Cassandra, we are not going to see a big change in systems probably anytime sooner overnight in this country. So the system is what it is at least for the foreseeable future. And there will be people listening who are going to be pregnant for the first time. What advice would you have for them?
I mean, read your plan. I hate to say it, but, you know, read your plan and make choices before you even try to start getting pregnant, because it could take a month or it could take years. And unfortunately, you just don't know. And so it's better to be prepared and eat the cost of paying for those higher, you know, premium plans for however many years it takes. But I understand and empathize how hard that is. If you pay that premium every month and every month you don't get pregnant, it's heartbreaking. And so I there's nothing more you can do besides plan. It's an insurance policy for a reason. You have to pay for those things. You have to start saving money and then make hard choices. I think if you want to be financially stable and have children, you have to make hard choices about how many children you have.
Yeah, I mean, for people who are Lyman Stone, a conservative writer who's a natalist who wants to see higher birth rates, has also written that there has to be more robust supports and more transparent systems to encourage people not to be fearful of what the cost could be or to maybe kind of deter from decision-making like this. Mohini, final thoughts from you in our last 30 seconds? Go ahead.
Sure. I think as long as the system is what it is, the answer is yes, be as informed as you can, do what you can. But I think the real answer here is to not accept the system. It doesn't have to be like this. What we need are systemic answers, things like the New York Health Act that will make a universal single-payer system, which will solve a lot of these issues. And the way you get that is to organize and fight for it with your community. And that goes for so many other aspects, whether that's in housing, whether that's at the workplace. People are being set up to fail financially and pay for things that have no reason to be that expensive. And until we organize and fight for something better with solutions that are tangible.
Rochester now has miles. I'm sorry, Mohini, I heard something underneath there, but go ahead, finish the point.
I was just going to say, like, until we organize and fight for these tangible systemic solutions, it will continue being this hard. So let's not accept that, and let's do something about it together.
Well, sharing what our guests have shared is personal and can be tough at times. And Mohini Sharma, Organizing Director at Metro Justice, I appreciate you being willing to do that. Thank you for being on the program.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Cassandra Nichols, mother of two children, hasn't always been easy there either. Thank you for sharing your experience with that.
Thanks for having me.
And our thanks to Jane Dodds joining us earlier, a recently retired medical practice administrator. More connections coming up in a moment.